Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we talk with Randy Graff. We also review A Man's a Man at Classic Stage Company, Ewan Morton at the Players Club, the new group's production of Intimacy, Michelle Lee at 54 Below, Regroup Theater's production of The House of Connolly, and Lincoln Center presents the American Songbook with Michael John LaChiusa. Please stay tuned for more.
8,000 feet above the
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, February 2nd, 2014. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. His work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at Follow Spot Photo and as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
So I hear that today is the Tony Awards of football. What do you think?
Oh, how I hate the Denver Broncos, but that's another story. Anyway.
Any good football plays that we... I guess Lombardi was a good football player, sort of.
Musicals, of course. Good News back in the 20s. There was also...
All-American?
All-American certainly dealt with football. That's a Strauss and Adams show from 62, which yielded the standard Once Upon a Time, A Girl with Moonlight in Her Eyes. I would have loved to have seen that show, I think, in 1946 called Toplitzky of Notre Dame, which sounds hilarious to me. But anyway, sure. Yeah, sports do crop up every now and then, no question about it, in musicals, usually as lyrics, though, more than a subject matter. I'm trying to think of a good quiz to have in the months to come, just quoting lyrics from sporting events, because there's plenty of them in musicals, even though people don't necessarily think so. So that's for the future.
Before I saw it, I thought The Boys from Syracuse was a football musical.
Aha, sure. Gotcha.
And word has it, I read in Variety, that my alma mater is Penn State, and there's going to be a Joe Paterno movie with Al Pacino in it. And
wow,
I think that would sort of make a good play on Broadway, I think.
Wow.
So look for that, you know, 5-10 years from now.
Yeah.
With us this morning, we have a special guest. Randy Graff has joined us. Our listeners know Randy, of course, from 10 or so different shows on Broadway that she's done, starting with Grease. Savara? Did I say that correctly?
Sarava.
Oh, you don't even have to mention that.
Well,
Michael, did you see that Sarava? Actually, it's pronounced Sarava.
Sarava. Well, we're going to have to come back to that now that you've opened up the can of worms. Then you went to the other one that I can't pronounce, that Les Miserables.
Oh, we call that Les Mis.
Les Mis. City of Angels, Falsettos, Laughter on the 23rd Floor, Moon Over Buffalo, High Society, a class act. And then Fiddler on the Roof, the 2004 revival. So, Randy, thank you for joining us on a Sunday morning over your tea.
Thank you.
So, Randy, you have a concert coming up at 54 Below. This is coming up on February 17th at 7 p.m. And another show has just been added on March 5th at 9:30. So tell us, after, having so much work on Broadway and television and all the other arts, and now you're at 54 Below, what is 54 Below going to mean for you?
Well, it's funny because I've been thinking about doing a cabaret act for probably over 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I attempted to do one in the 80s. I was actually going around and getting songs from unknown composers at that time, like Alan Menken.
Uh-huh. He'll never mention anything.
I went to Alan Menken's home when he lived in the tiny apartment in Manhattan Plaza, and he was giving me trunk songs, you know, before Alan Menken was Alan Menken. Mm-hmm. We all came up together, so we all knew each other. And then I think I got Les Mis, and so the idea went away. I stayed away from cabaret for a long time for a couple of reasons. I never really had the desire to do it because I would go see friends and they would do it so beautifully and I would applaud for them and think, but I just couldn't see myself up there. And then I think probably in all truth, there was a little part of me that was a little afraid of that genre because it's just you up there, you know, it's not you playing with other people other than the musicians, but it's not you playing a character. And I just kind of shied away from it. There was a little bit of, it was a little daunting for me. And over the years, people have always asked me, when are you going to do an act? When are you going to do an act? And, oh, no, it's not for me. It's not for me. And then when 54 Below opened, then my friend started saying to me, you have to play there. You have to play there. You know, it's the law and order of cabaret. Every actor has to play there. And I really seriously started thinking about it. And then they invited me there when I helped them open it, not individually, but there were groups of us who were singing. And they asked me, when are you going to come here and do your show? And I said, well, I don't have one, so I guess I should get one. And I started talking about it with my husband, who's a musical director. And I said, honey, I think it's time. I think it's time for me to do it, and I really would like to play that room, but I'm only going to do it if you're my musical director. And, excuse me, Tim agreed to do it, and then the ball got rolling. So I'm very excited about it. It's not one of those career retrospectives. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to do something a little bit more personal, less career oriented, and more closer to the heart. So I decided to call the show Made in Brooklyn, which is where I'm from. And I tell stories about growing up in Brooklyn, which is kind of colorful and fun. And all of the songs were written by and made famous by people born in Brooklyn.
Ah.
So it's really quite eclectic, and I think people will have fun and learn a little something about some of the incredible talent that came out of Brooklyn. I mean, I sing Marvin Hamlisch and Carole King and Gershwin and Betty Comden and Harry Nilsson, and, you know, it's just kind of all over the map. And it's been really fun to work on, and especially fun because my husband, my musical director and arranger, he's the cool one in the family, so he really brings. I'm the Broadway one, and he's kind of like the cool jazz pop guy. So he brings the cool quotient up, and so the arrangements are really very hip. And I'm excited about it. It's a little daunting, but I'm excited about it.
We should mention that the husband / musical director to whom Randy refers is Tim Weil, who was the original musical director for Rent.
Right. Yes. Thank you for mentioning that.
And I love your press release for your show where you mentioned some of the famous Brooklynites. I don't suppose you're doing any opera in your show. If you were, you could have mentioned Maria Callas and Beverly Sills.
I know, but you know, I'm not an opera singer, no. But isn't that amazing, Maria? The people that were born in Brooklyn, I mean, when you Google it.
Incredible.
You know, from A to Z, it just pops up. And I could do a sequel to this, but I'm not. I'll probably do something a little different after this. But I do, you know, for me, the very first performer I thought of who was made in Brooklyn was, of course, Barbara Streisand. And so the only theater story I tell was the night is when Barbara Streisand came to see Les Mis, because that was a very special moment in my life, because she was so, and I talk about this as well, how influential she was when I was 12 years old and I listened to her for the first time. So I talk about her influence on me, and then later what it was like to perform for her. That's my Babs is in there. Not Bubbles, but Babs.
Now, Randy, Brooklyn, of course, has become extraordinarily hot in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
What neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in Canarsie. Uh-huh. That's where I grew up, Canarsie, Brooklyn, which is not a chic neighborhood. Never was, never will be.
I don't know. For Saturday Night Fever, it was a pretty hot neighborhood.
So,
but that wasn't, I don't think that was Canarsie.
Bay Ridge. Bay Ridge.
Oh, Bay Ridge is getting up there too, isn't it? I'm not sure.
I think so, yeah. I've heard. So I've heard, yes.
Peter,
yeah.
What was your question? We interrupted.
No, I was going to ask about going to Wagner College. Now, of course, when people think of musical theater schools, alphabetically what they think of is Carnegie Mellon, Cincinnati, and Michigan. But nevertheless, Wagner has a wonderful department, and you're certainly one of the shining stars from Wagner. I did see one show at Wagner towards the end of Lowell Matson's reign out there.
And oh, my goodness.
And it was a production of Chicago, which was meticulously replicated from the original production. So I got the impression that that's what he did. What did you do at Wagner, in fact? What were your favorite roles there?
I can answer some of that question.
You saw everything and you reviewed it. Tell him, Michael.
Go ahead. I'm ready.
I overlapped with Randy 1 year. The one that stands out for me is Company. She was a great Joanne in Company.
Uh-huh.
What else? Moon Children.
Oh, my God.
Moon Children.
You know, the thing, Michael, it's so funny that you say Company. I was 19 years old playing Joanne. I had no idea what that woman was about. I just imitated Stritch on the album.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even know she had a drinking problem. I didn't know I didn't know anything. I just imitated Stritch. That's all I did.
Everybody has to go through stages like that.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
And I guess maybe those were the only two that I saw you in, because I don't think I saw you anything until I got there. What else did you do there?
Oh, Dames at Sea.
Uh-huh.
When I was tap dancing, I played Joan.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Good Times Are Here to Stay. That was my big song. And Man of La Mancha, the innkeeper's wife, I played Maria. And I was a courtesan when I first, that was my first show. I was a courtesan in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Oh, that sounds good. So now let's jump to the night of the Tony Awards in 1990. There you are. City of Angels is a much acclaimed show, but so is Grand Hotel. And Jane Krakowski's mm-hmm. awfully good, too. What did you feel was going to happen that night?
I didn't know I was going to win. I thought I had a good shot.
Uh-huh.
And I thought Jane was great. I thought there was a good chance that Jane would win.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a little something prepared, and then I can't remember. Well, all I remember that night about the Tony Awards is that I got locked out after I won my award.
I love this story.
Do you know this story, Michael?
Yeah, you tell me, because
these
were in the days when you had to go to another
room,
theater, a building.
Well, a restaurant next door that's still there, Sophia's. They would take us outside. Well, first they take, the minute you win your Tony, they take it away from you. And then you go, because they go and they have to have it engraved. And then they ushered me to the restaurant. Actually, I think there was a way to go. No, I think I went outside to the restaurant, did the press junket, and then came back in with, I wasn't ushered, so they couldn't get me back in, so I was banging on the stage door. It was locked. I couldn't get back in, banging on the stage door. Let me in, let me in. I just want a Tony. Let me in, let me in, let me in. And the guy woke up and said, who are you? I said, I'm Randy Gruff. I just want a Tony. And he let me back in. That's what I remember about that night.
I've tried that. They don't let me in. I say, I'm Randy Graff. I just want a Tony.
I'll lend you mine.
We got that on tape. Okay. So, Randy, you were so, shall I say, colorful about when I mentioned your second show on Broadway. Sarava.
I took it off my resume.
Didn't you see the endless commercials on TV, James, at the time? They were shameless in the way that they advertised.
I don't remember it. So,
God. Sarava. I mean, listen to the lyrics. I will tell you the lyrics. Sarava. Sarava. Sarava means we are lovers. What's your name? That's one of the lyrics.
This is the closest we're going to get to a cast album.
Look, I can't complain. It was my Broadway, my first Broadway show where I originated a role. I played Tova Felch's sister, Rosalia. I called myself Rosalia Felcher. And we never opened. Mm. We truly never opened. Right. We previewed for 6 months, and then the critics came in and reviewed us. We never opened. I walked through the stage door one afternoon, and there was a big, this is when Joe Allen's used to give presents of baskets of fruit, apples specifically, to shows that were opening. They don't do it anymore. So I walked in, there was a big basket of apples from Joe Allen's, and I said to the stage, you know, to the doorman, what's this? And he says, it's from Joe Allen's. I guess we're opening.
Yes, that was a big scandal. Is that one where the critics banded together and just came anyway?
Yep.
I was given 100 free tickets for the first preview.
I had to
pay for the show. And there I was in the first balcony with 100 of my friends there. And the only balcony, this was at the Hellinger, God rest his soul. Anyway, I remember at intermission, you know, people started booing me. My friends were booing me.
Booing you for bringing them there?
Right, yeah. I mean, I actually put my hands up in my face the way criminals do when they're caught and arrested, you know what I mean?
That's hysterical.
So that's my memory of Sarava.
The whole Sarava thing is such a joke. I'll tell you, when Tim and I got married, Lonnie Price was our best man, and he was making the speech, and I said, listen, tell everyone that if they don't want to say L'chaim after we break the glass, they can say Sarava. So after, there was one person who went, Sarava, after we broke the glass. And Tim also tells me that when he used to be a sub, when he first came to New York and he was subbing in the Broadway pits, he was subbing the Secret Garden, and at the very end of the score, it said, Sarava.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
I hear Michael laughing, because it meant the end. It meant the end.
What a big metaphor.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's like shalom. It's hello and goodbye, as I recall.
I have to
admit, for a few weeks, I did answer the phone, Sarava. I remember friends started saying, "How long, oh Lord? How long will this go on?"
Didn't the pit players at the end of City of Angels scream something?
Oh, yeah.
They didn't scream Sarava, thank God.
No, they grunted.
They just screamed. They just went, huh, like that.
Best out music ever in the history of Broadway.
Oh, it's City of Angels, such a incredible on stage from the pit, from every aspect.
And only Cy Coleman could have written it.
That's
funniest lyrics.
On Broadway.
Hysterical.
So, yeah. Oh, tremendous lyrics, no question. God bless David Sippen, tremendous work, so...
You know, Randy, I've just been awash in Cy Coleman lately, which is a wonderful thing because I saw Michelle Lee did her act at 54.
Oh, and, I love her.
Yeah, and so there was, you know, she gave a very moving tribute to him, and she even played a little tape of him singing a demo of, not a demo, I mean, his recording of, I guess, when he wrote her big tour de force number in Seesaw at the 11th hour. And so he made a recording of it and gave it to her, and she played a little of that. So that was incredible. And
then, goosebumps.
Yeah, and then we have little me coming up. So he's very much around in the zeitgeist right now, and I think that's great because there's nobody greater than him really.
Mm. I feel the same way, and there's a big book coming up about all about him, written by Andy
Probst.
Probst. Andy Probst.
Yeah, that's right. Overdue. Yes. Yeah, that's great.
All right, so let's remind everybody that you can go to 54below.com, and there's all the information on Randy's show coming up on the 17th at 7 p.m. and on March 5th at 9:30 p.m. And So, Randy, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning.
It was a pleasure to have tea with you guys.
Thank you. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, I'm sorry that we only have 15 minutes with our guests sometimes in the morning, because I feel like Randy could fill two or three shows with her stories. It's great.
You know, it's funny. What I didn't bring up with her, because I didn't want to embarrass her at all. Lowell Mattson, the teacher at Wagner, eventually stopped teaching there because he was caught growing marijuana in his backyard. Michael, do you know about this?
Yes.
You know, and the thing is, as I say, the Chicago that I saw there was perfectly replicated from the original Broadway production. In fact, I wish the people who did the revival could have gone there to see it so they would know exactly how to do the revival. Not that it suffered. But anyway, here's my point. A guy who smokes marijuana, you would really think, would have wild ideas about doing musicals and not do them by the template that they were done on Broadway. You know, I mean, you'd think he'd say, hey, Chicago, the windy city, but Dodge City, Kansas is really the windy city in the country. Let's set Chicago there. That'd be great. You know, but no, I mean, he really did follow the template. He went to these shows on Broadway a million times and took every note as to where every piece of blocking was, and that's what you got. And I'm telling you, once I saw that Chicago, I said to myself, I am never missing a Lowell Mattson production of a play I've never seen, because I want to see them done exactly as they were done. Unfortunately, that's when he was arrested, and that was the end of that. But
having done several shows with him, yes, he was not about that at all. He was very much about replicating. Of course, whoever the choreographer was, you know, had a big hand in that also. We did a 1776 that I think was very much along the lines of the original. Let's see. I did.
You were it, Michael?
Yes, I was in it. Yeah.
Who were you?
I was appropriately enough the guy from New York in But Mr.
Oops.
Adams.
Roger Sherman then. Is that the one?
Yes, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Livingston with all the Livingstons together back in old New York.
Okay. So you weren't the one who abstained courteously.
No, I didn't get. No, that was somebody else. That show is so well written to give, you know, so many opportunities to so many people.
That's a good point.
So the guy who's in the number is not the one who abstains courteously, and you know, and so on. But and then my senior show was You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and of course that was not still running at that point, but presumably Lowell had seen it and you know, remembered it, and I guess there's not that much. Well, I mean, there's some freedom in the staging, but I think we did it as it was originally conceived with the blocks, you know, or that.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, that's the way here. And you know, I mean, I certainly think that in a college, I wonder if I imagine you'd agree, Peter, in a college setting, there's nothing wrong with that because
nothing whatsoever. And yeah. I don't mean to imply otherwise. In fact, I was thrilled to see the original staging. As I say, I was going to hit everything that I hadn't seen before. So but anyway, it was not to be.
So I didn't ask Randy something that the perfect opportunity with Michael here is that in one of the Forbidden Broadways, Gerard Alessandrini said Randy Graff fell into the band. And I've read that never actually happened, but I wanted to get her take on it.
What show was that, Cindy Bagels?
No, it was in the Les Mis sequence for Forbidden Broadway.
Oh.
And he says, Randy Graff fell into the band, and the turntable's making us dizzy, that type of thing. And certainly, I read that Gerard made that up, but I wanted her take on it. But
well, Forbidden Broadway is coming back, but I don't imagine they'll resurrect that lyric. So.
No, not that one. No. Well, Gerard says that's one of the reasons he's bringing it back, because there's a new Les Mis revival. So plenty of things to talk about there.
Didn't he refer to it as a call to arms?
Yes, he did.
Les Mis coming back for the third time. You know, how can they not do Forbidden Broadway? Yes.
Though I remember talking to Gerard many years ago and saying, what's your next Forbidden Broadway going to be called? And he said, Forbidden Broadway Beats a Dead Horse. You know, I mean, I've just done so many of them, you know, so, but anyway, I'm sorry, James, I interrupted you.
Okay. We should move on to our
news. Sooner the better.
Well, maybe not the sooner the better. So a man's man opened up a classic stage company, and Peter got a chance to see it. So, Peter, tell us about it.
Well, you know, I'm wondering about one line more than anything else. There's an allusion to an elephant, and somebody says, "What elephant?" And, you know, that's a very famous line from Jumbo, the Rodgers and Hart musical, when Jimmy Durante was stealing an elephant from the circus and got caught, and was, "Hey, what are you doing with that elephant? What elephant?" So I don't know if this is really quite the Brecht play that was done way back when, but nevertheless, this is a pretty pokey evening, I have to admit. And there is that statement that when you hear a noise, you lose a tiny, tiny part of your hearing. Well, you're going to lose a lot when you see a man's a man, because there are drums on the stage, industrial strength sized metal drums. And I'm telling you, they never tire of hitting hammers on these drums, and they will drive you crazy. I will say this, though. Justin Vivian Bond is giving a terrific performance as a woman. Now, the thing is, it's unfair to say woman a man, because Justin Vivian Bond prides him/herself as being gender free, as I understand it. In fact, if you go to the website for Bond, you will see that there's no MR or MS, but MX, because again, gender is something that Bond does not want to assign Bond. Here, Bond plays a woman, and she is sensational at it. If it weren't for the voice, I really believe you would believe this is a genuine woman. And there she is in the Brecht concept of commenting on the action. So that's a very good performance. I also have to say, Andrew Weems, an actor I know from the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey, is one that had to come in quickly because Bill Buell got terribly injured and had to leave the show. And it was nice to see him. I was not a fan of the approach to Spring Awakening, but nevertheless, I did think some of the music was lovely. And I really liked the new music that was here by Duncan Sheik. So I liked that as well. I guess I haven't mentioned the story, which takes place in British colonial India. And it's about a guy who has a name that's rather provocative today, Gaily Gay. He's drafted into the armed forces. And it's some of it has to do with brainwashing and conformity and how they're going to make this man into a man in that way. But I have to admit, it was very hard for me to concentrate. I tuned out quite a bit. It was quite long, and I didn't enjoy myself as much as I expected to. Brian Kulik, the director, has made it look good. Certainly the staging is more entertaining to me than the play itself. So not something I can recommend terribly highly. What did you think, James? Did you like it?
Well, I felt very much the same as you did, that I felt that I wish they would stop beating the drums. They were 55-gallon steel 55-gallon steel drums that, you know, house industrial goods that they've turned into musical instruments, and they punctuated a lot of points. You know, I felt there was a lot of indication happening there.
Sure.
Justin Bond, as you said, really, I felt stole the show. You know, it really, a total commitment, an incredible cast up on stage there. A wonderful cast. Just, I just felt that the execution on it was, I don't even think that they could have picked their, you know, when you say the show's running long, you pick up your cues. I don't even think that would have helped there. It was just a long show. They tried to accomplish a whole lot there, and I wasn't sure of what type of genre they were trying to appeal to. But certainly Classic Stage Company, you know, tries to reinvent the classics and get them out there. And this is what they did there. It didn't quite succeed for me on this one.
No, for me either. But yes, it's one of the best places in town. I enjoy going there all the time. And it's a very nice setting. The company's been around quite a bit of time. I remember going there in the 70s. So not under the same management, of course, but nevertheless, it obviously has done something right to be in business all these years.
Sure.
They are a terrific company overall. They have had quite a bad patch recently, but let's just remind people that happens sometimes.
Sure, absolutely. Yes.
You know, so, it doesn't necessarily mean, oh, you know, let's give up on them.
I agree.
They have that wonderful little cafe in front as you're entering the theater, and so I grabbed a cup of coffee, and it was like, you know, 2 minutes to curtain. I grabbed a cup of coffee and I'm walking in. He's like, oh, you can't bring that in. And I was like, what? I just purchased it right here. You tell me, you watch me purchase it and walk up to the door and you tell me I can't bring it in. And he said, just hide it from me.
Interestingly enough, that cafe is caught on as a cafe itself.
Yeah.
Plenty of people go there to sit and enjoy the wares and have no intention of going to the show. In fact, some people have even complained about that. Wow, you know, there's no place for me to sit here because all these other people who aren't theater goers are sitting here enjoying themselves in no time and are in no hurry to get going. So that's interesting too.
And the last thing, this is indicative of my comment here, but I forgot that Duncan Sheik had written the music, and I'm a big fan of Duncan Sheik, but I felt that it really added very little to nothing to this show.
I enjoyed the music immeasurably. I thought it was lovely. Yeah. So, definitely a highlight of the show for me. Mm. I thought it was very evocative.
I really couldn't remember a melody or theme out of it.
Well, that's another story, but nevertheless, while I was there, I liked what was washing over me.
Okay.
Well, regardless, and I haven't seen this show, but I hope he continues to write for musical theater.
Because
I really do. I mean, I some of the lyrics in Spring Awakening are very odd, but I think the music overall is really terrific. And some incredibly beautiful songs in that Left Behind song that will just destroy you, and several others. So I do hope he keeps at it. Haven't we heard of some other projects?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, be 100% honest here is that I had absolutely no interest in going to see this until I saw Duncan Sheik had written music. And then I said, oh, I'll go see it. And now it made no impact on me. Anyway, let's move forward into other musical realms. And Michael went to the Players Club to see Ewan Morton, who we spoke to a few weeks ago. Michael, give us a quick synopsis on the evening.
It was a really terrific show. It was concept was that it was actually taking place in the 1920s. and he performed with this group called Grandpa Musselman and His Syncopators. And that is a sort of a little joke in itself, a little wry joke, because it seemed to me that the average age of the guys in this band was like 19. It was so fantastic. I don't know that I should read up a little more on their history, such as it is. It's an incredible recreation of a 20s, you know, swing jazz sound, they played so beautifully and just with such great style. And I've never heard that kind of music played live that I can recall, and it was a plus that it was played live without amplification at the Players Club. Where are you going to have that experience? Ewan was amplified as the singer because there was all that brass on stage, so that made sense. But it really was terrific, and just a great program of old songs something you're really not going to encounter very often and unique. And I'm so glad I went. And he has more coming up. So check I'm sure there's a website or something we can point you to, and try to get down there if you can. As James mentioned when we spoke to you, and the tickets are extremely reasonable. I think $20 or $25. And plus, on top of all that, you get to be in the Players Club, which is a very historic place, which is unfortunately going through financial difficulties. So it's conceivable that it might not always be there. I mean, I hate to even say that, but you know, I mean, maybe it will. Maybe, you know, hopefully they own the building, so that's a big plus. But it's very historic, and also the place right next door to it, the National Arts Club, just really, you know, old New York club type atmosphere that's something in and of itself. So I highly recommend it.
All right. So next up, Peter got to see the new group's production of Intimacy down at the Acorn. So Peter, tell us about that.
All right. I'm going to go out on a limb on this one. Now, this is a very sexual play. There's a lot of nudity. There's even, I won't say bathroom humor, but bathroom scenes. I guess some people would find it humorous to see people sitting on the throne and doing what comes naturally. So this is a very raw show by Thomas Bradshaw, no question about it. But I think it tells the truth, because it deals with the fact that all of us have imaginations beyond belief where it comes to sexuality, and things that we haven't tried or might try or would try or could try. This is what this play deals with. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to say, oh, people would never do things like that. I disagree. And I think they would. I think they do. And I think that this play, while diffuse and crazy and off the wall, most of the time is on target in the way that dealing with secrets of sexuality that people don't want to admit they have. And yet they do. So we all have our dark sides, every one of us, and this is what this play is about. And that's what makes it fascinating to me. I will admit, it's long. It's occasionally boring. It'd be nice if it were cut a bit. Scott Elliott has done the best he could in directing it, because it is a sprawling work. It might have been good if he could have convinced the playwright to drop a little bit here, a little bit there. But my hat is off to the cast, too, especially old pros like Daniel Jarrell and Laura Esteban, because you know, they have to do a lot of things that they don't expect to do. They never expected to do when they got into the business, believe me. So provocative, titillating, yeah, but truthful, too. I'll stand by that.
But how do you feel about that specific thing, Peter, about requiring, of course, no one has to be in it,
right?
But that's about right. Requiring actors to do incredibly graphic things on stage.
Obviously, these people were willing to do it, you know, and that's what it comes down to. Nobody was holding a gun to their head. Either they needed the work desperately, and we've all heard of actors saying, "I took the job because I needed the insurance, the time for the insurance." Equity has rules on about that. Who knows? We may be seeing all insurance cases up there for all I know. But nevertheless, the fact remains, it's a free country. They weren't drafted into this. They auditioned for it. They knew what they were getting into. And I have to say that one of the important parts of this play is, again, doing what comes naturally, acting as if nothing bizarre is going on. That isn't true for every character or every step of the way. But a lot of it has to do with people coming out and frankly admitting what they want. And that's handled very, very nicely here. The naturalistic style of this is right in place. So I understand if this play gets terrible reviews. I understand people not liking it or being and certainly being offended by it. Yeah. Or not believing it. I believed it.
All right. So I have to say that most of the discussion that I've heard about Intimacy is all about the nudity and the shockingness of it all, and nobody's really talking about the story itself.
It's just such a slippery, I mean, like, Yeah, I mean, it's that's so interesting what you said about maybe they're desperate for work. Laura Esterman is someone who at one point had incredible promise.
Absolutely.
That was not fulfilled, you know, so I don't know, maybe this is all she feels she can get. I don't know. Irene, I honestly don't know. But that's one scenario.
I am sure what you mean, Michael, when you say was not fulfilled was the fact that she didn't get the opportunities to fulfill them as opposed to she didn't have the talent to fulfill them.
Oh, well, no, I mean, I certainly think she had the talent based on her one breakout role, Marvin's Room.
Marvin's Room. Yeah, indeed.
Yes. So I haven't that's another thing I don't know is why she didn't have the whether it was her own bad choices or other people not appreciating her. I really don't know.
Any career that lasts is a miracle. Anyone. I mean, you know, so she just didn't have the luck that other people have. I mean, but it certainly has nothing to do with her lack of abilities. And I know you didn't mean to imply that. I understand that. You know, there's nothing beats the right place at the right time. I mean, you know, and she was at the right place at the right time for Marvin's Room. But yes.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to imply lack of abilities.
Oh, I know that. I know that. I'm not accusing you of that. Believe me.
But perhaps it was lack of, you know, knowing how to run her career to some extent and being, you know, and choices as to who, you know, who to work with and who to represent her and things like that. I don't know.
Yeah,
but and then you have I have not seen Intimacy, but I've heard that at least one person in it is very young and just out of college or whatever. One of the male actors who I'm told has a scene where he appears to ejaculate into the audience.
Yes.
Yeah. True. So I just, you know, I.
Yes.
call me crazy, but I think
No. Nobody's calling you crazy. I'm sure more people are going to call me crazy. Believe me. Oh, I'm going to hear about this. No question. But
we're talking about two different things. You're saying that the play is truthful, and that doesn't necessarily negate what I'm saying.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. We're not arguing.
Okay.
All right, so a lot of things were thrown around just now about right place at the right time and a long career and very talented and all those things.
Orgasms on stage.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you just screwed up my transition there.
Well, maybe not.
Well, James.
So Michael saw Michelle Lee at 54 Below.
Nobody does it like her. Maybe, you know.
Nobody does it better. Or Call Me Maybe. We'll be talking about Carly Rae Jepsen soon, won't we now? All right. So Michael saw Michelle at 54 Below. So Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, as far as I know, she did not actually have an orgasm on stage, but she is an extremely intense, very committed performer. And I mean, I had problems with the show. I had problems with the patter. I had problems with some of the interpretations, but I will say that she looks amazing and her voice is in absolutely incredible shape for someone her age and even for someone not her age. I mean, if you told me that she was 50 or 40 or 40, I would say, boy, what a great voice. She hasn't developed that wobble that some belters do when they get older. Her vibrato is still really tight and really forceful. And she just gave a great show, you know, really communicating with the audience. And again, some of it was a little, to me, was a little affected. One specific thing I would suggest to her, if I knew her, she has Ron Abel is her music director, and then she has like three or four other people in the band, all of whom are women, which was a nice touch. But one of them is playing a keyboard. And the keyboard is fine as long as it's not attempting to sound like a string section. And as soon as it does that, The whole thing suddenly to me has an incredibly cheesy sound to it, like some like fourth-rate entertainment you might see on a really bad cruise ship. So I wish they had rethought that, because I don't think it was necessary, and I think that really brought the show down a few notches. But as far as Michelle Lee's voice and, you know, her energy, it was really quite something. Let's see. Liza Minnelli was in the audience. Oh, I sat at the table with Howard McGillin, who said he had not worked with her, but that he knew her through various channels and, you know, was a big fan. Sandra Bernhardt was there, and it was packed. And it was really, you know, the kind of thing that one, and a perfect example of the kind of thing you can see at 54 Below, with which we were discussing earlier with Randy Graff. They have some really, 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 really great programming. And as I've said on several occasions before, please keep them. Check their website. You wouldn't believe who they have coming up. I mean, no matter when you look, they always have incredible shows there. So check them out.
All right. Next up, Peter got to see House of Connolly at the Abington Theater. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
This is a production by the Regroup Theater. And the reason it's called that is because what they're doing is recreating what the Group Theater, that famous organization back in the 30s that so many luminaries were connected with, from Cheryl Crawford to Harold Klerman, etc. So the company's been around for a couple of years, thanks to a very enterprising young man and a very talented director named Ali Mulholland. And he will go to any lengths whatsoever to make us see these shows that were so influential in the 10 or so years that the Group Theater was together back then. So The House of Connolly is by Paul Green. And we think of Paul Green mostly from those outdoor dramas that take place in places like North Carolina and what have you. In fact, wasn't there a Tony Award given to The Lost Colony a year or so ago? It seems to me there was. Yeah. Anyway, he did a number of plays and also a musical with Kurt Vile, Johnny Johnson. But I was there twice this week at the Abington to see not only The House of Connolly, but also another Paul Green play in a reading. Which is In Abraham's Bosom. And that was on Sunday night. That was a Pulitzer Prize winner from 27. And what Paul Green had in his mind was race relations. And he was very much a staunch candidate for better race relations. In fact, his daughter was in the audience for the for In Abraham's Bosom and told the story about when Richard Wright, the author of Native Son, came to their town, their southern town in North Carolina. And when he came through the front door, the town went crazy. They wanted to lynch him for being so bold as to using the front door. And Paul Green had to do a lot of fancy talking to calm everybody down. So that's the type of milieu that we're talking about here. And that's what Paul Green was writing about. The House of Connolly is a play about people who suddenly are poor white trash. They didn't expect to be, but nevertheless, they have been a tremendously influential and rich family in town, but now they no longer are. And how are they going to keep this from everybody? And how are they going to maintain their lifestyle? Will one of the people in the family have to marry somebody he doesn't want to because it would be financially advantageous? These questions do come up, but to see the decline and fall of a once proud family, and also to see people get their comeuppance that we want them to get, makes for quite a riveting enterprise. But I really recommend, tonight I'm going again. I mean, yeah, the Super Bowl is on, but I'll miss some of it because at 7 o'clock they're doing that play that Richard Wright and Paul Green wrote together, Native Son. So this is a group that's worth keeping an eye on. Pay attention to when they're doing shows, especially the stage readings, which are free. There's even like wine and cheese after. So God bless Sally Mulholland, who really works very, very hard. And type of guy who, when he hears that there's a script of the group theater that he hasn't discovered up till then, you know, if somebody wants $100 for it, he pays it. He just has to recreate this era. He's intent on doing it. And I think he's terrific.
Native Son was a book that I read in high school, I believe, that was on the reading list. I would really be interested in seeing the stage version of it. I mean, seeing this thing you're discussing here.
Yeah, I'm so sorry that it's too late for our listeners to go, because by the time they hear this, the reading will have come and gone. But nevertheless, maybe I'll see you there tonight at 7 o'clock, Michael.
Yeah.
All right. Next up on the list, Michael got over to
the Allen Room.
Was it the Allen Room? Is that where the songbook is?
Yes, American Songbook does at least some of their programs in the amazing Allen Room in the Time Warner Center, which
I'm
sure we've discussed before. It's
beautiful view of Central Park.
Yeah, yeah. And I, for whatever reason, I had not been there in quite some time, and it's always amazing to go into that space. The friend I brought had never been there, and he was quite overwhelmed. Their secret is that they do shows and concerts that are so good that the park view doesn't distract you. In this case, it was really one of the best shows of its kind that I've seen. It was called Heartbreak Country, Michael John Lacuse's Stories of America. It was conceived and directed by Jack Cummings III of the Transport Group, that has done more than one of Lacuse's shows, and it was very well written, with each of the performers doing some narration and kind of setting the scene and quoting Lacuse about his various works. And let me say right away that how's this for a group of performers? Kate Baldwin, Sherry D. Boone, Mark Kudish, Bryce Rhinus, Andrew Szymanski, Emily Skinner, and Mary Testa. With Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director and piano, and then let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other musicians, one of whom my friend remarked, Stephen Lyon. It says reeds, but he not only did he have two or three different reeds that he was playing at various points, but he also had some woodwinds. So he was really working, and it just sounded so great. The main impression that I got was how incredibly ridiculous it is that some people have said that Lacuse doesn't write melodies, because it was so melodic. All of these great songs from Marie Christine and Hello Again and Queen of the Mist and Giant, and so on and so on and so on. See What I Want to See. You know, it's, as I've said before, it's not lack of melody. It's just that the songs are, I guess, more complex than the Great American Songbook type songs that we always say, oh, you know, you walk out humming the tune. When you think about it, a lot of those, most of those pre-Sondheim American musical theater songs that we remember were really, I mean, they were great. Don't get me wrong, but they're rather simple in construction. You know, they're AABA or maybe ABAB format, and there's more repetition, and so obviously it's going to be I would think it would be easier to remember a melody when it's presented, when it's repeated, and when it's presented in a simpler form. But this is, you know, something more complex, even more complex than a lot of Sondheim, I would say. But not to say that there's no melody, because that's completely untrue. It's just flowing with melody, and this proved it to anyone who would say otherwise. One really nice moment was Mark Kudish sang one of the songs from "See What I Want to See," and I had forgotten that one. It actually takes place in Central Park, and one of the characters actually sings a song about how he quit his job as a he just like walked out of his job as a, I think, like a CPA or a Wall Street job or something like that, and he like basically ran to Central Park to live there, you know, to like retreat from the daily grind, and he's singing about how he ran to actually to Columbus Circle, and there we were, you know, sitting right in Columbus Circle and looking out over it and the park, and so that was a really nice moment, and you know, there was some little giggles in the audience, but it really was terrific. And Mark also did an amazing job with some of Burr's songs from the Lacusa version of The Wild Party. I don't know if Mark Kudish has actually played that role anywhere, but I would love to see him do the whole thing because she was great. And Emily Skinner was in top form. Sherry D. Boone, who I'm not that familiar with, but she really did great with some really fierce belting and also high soprano. And Kate Baldwin and Bryce Reines and Mary Testa and Andrew Szymanski, who I always love. They just had a real showcase. It was a showcase for them as well as for Lacusa, and really very well put together by Jack Cummings III.
So, you know, Kudish, Skinner, all these other folks involved, you know, New York's a big town. Can't they get anybody with talent?
Speaking of New York, I will say that for anybody who lives from out of town and wants to come to New York and have a quintessential New York experience, I doubt that there's another room in the city where you really feel like you're in New York. And not just because Central Park is there or Columbus Circle is there. There's just something so ultra sophisticated about that space that I love it dearly. And I hope that everybody takes a chance when they're in New York to go there and see something if something is playing there at that moment, because you'll raise a glass to yourself and to the city and be very proud of yourself for being there that night.
It's primarily a home of jazz at Lincoln Center.
Sure.
So if you like jazz and you like Wynton Marsalis, that's one more reason to check it out. But they just always have great programming there. And as Peter says, it's something really special.
I'm saying it's such a lovely room that if they put on a middle school play, I think you should go. You know,
it's a stunning room. It's a grand, great space.
And there's the other much larger, more conventional theater in the same building, the Rose Theater, which for whatever reason, that one I really have not been to that often or in a while. But
yeah,
when
only,
I had
only once for me. Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because I'm not. I'm not sure what, I guess that's also largely jazz from Lincoln Center, jazz at Lincoln Center, but they have done some musical theater programs there, and that's extraordinary too, because it's a completely different type, you know, much more, there's a lot of wood, great acoustics, just old style, you know, elegant as opposed to like really new and classy, and a lot of glass that you get at the Allen Room. But we are so lucky here. You know, we sometimes maybe take for granted what we have in terms of venues and talent, and we should never ever do that.
So coming up on the 13th, they have the Songs of Henry Krieger. They have 15th is Jonathan Groff.
Yes.
The 20th, Jessica Mulaski sings Joni Mitchell. It's just Jim Caruso's Cast Party Goes to the Movie is March 7th. Norm Lewis is March 8th. Oh, my goodness. You know, you just camp out and live there.
And I believe partly because it is Lincoln Center, which is a nonprofit organization, that there are lots of opportunities for, you know, decent price tickets that are not going to, like, you know, bankrupt you. So check that out also.
So I'm going to try to find this thing. We were talking before we started recording. They had a young person's discount for American Songbook. Pay what you can. American. I'll find it and I'll put it on the show notes.
Mentioned that, James.
Yeah, go to broadradio.com. And if I can find this link, it was a 35 and under pay what you can type of thing. So, yeah, check it out.
And it is, I should say, one of those places where there's literally not a bad seat. It just, absolutely, there isn't one, you know.
All right, moving on to the last review of the morning. Peter got a chance to see Riding the Midnight Express with Billy Hayes at the St. Luke's Theater. So
Peter. I may be wrong about this, but I recall when I saw Midnight Express, the movie, I believe it ended with Billy Hayes walking out of prison, not walking too fast, not walking too slow. He was escaping, but he had done some sort of ruse to get himself out of there, and he didn't want to call too much attention to himself. He wanted to make it look like just this regular stroll, because if he speeded up, maybe they'd be suspicious, and was very tense. But that's what I believe ended the film. I could be wrong. It's been a long time. However, here's the real Billy Hayes. The real Billy Hayes, up on stage telling us what happened after he walked out of that prison. And I'm telling you, it's a harrowing story. The show's about 80 minutes long. It's simply a monologue. There he is. He looks trim. He looks fit. He looks good. He's in his 60s. He's animated. He tells quite a fascinating story. And more to the point, what he went through is far more dramatic to me than the Midnight Express movie ever was. I'm amazed that it wasn't it didn't become a sequel, or I'm amazed that when they made the movie in the first place, they didn't include this as part of it. Because I'm telling you, this guy had to deal with the elements, and I am talking about wind, and I am talking about rain, and I am talking about sea, and I am talking about stretching himself and having to give up his shoes at one point and travel barefoot for the longest time and never knowing if somebody was right behind him. There was one point where he had to actually stick himself in the mud as soldiers were coming by. Luckily, they were otherwise engaged by singing a song and enjoying themselves, not knowing that somebody that they could capture was right next to them. A lot of stories like that, and I found it quite engrossing. But unless I'm wrong, and I may be, you know, it's been a long time since I saw that movie, but the real drama comes here. And while one-man shows often can be a little pokey, this one wasn't.
You know, just a little interesting story. I directed a production of Bent many years ago on Staten Island, early 80s. And I remember getting a call from Billy Hayes.
Wow.
Because I think he had just done a production somewhere. I cannot remember the details, and was interested in maybe being in ours, you know, in the central role of Max. And I remember, I wish I could remember more of the details. I was a little, I wasn't sure, because on the one hand, oh my God, you know, that's going to make it really noteworthy. But on the other hand, it was, you know, I mean, there was a community theater show and we usually used local actors. And if he became a part of it, then it would turn into this whole different thing. I don't, as I recall, I didn't have to make my decision because for whatever reason it didn't work out and he didn't pursue it or whatever. But did you by any chance ever see him in Bent, Peter?
No, I had no idea he did it.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find that out. I guess he had strong feelings about the play Bent because of his own experience as chronicled in Midnight Express. Sure. I would have loved to see him in that. You know,
I guess I should be clear about this for those who don't know Midnight Express. He was arrested in Turkey for carrying drugs, and he fully admits that he was young and crazy and shouldn't have done it. He certainly concedes that point readily, but he was put in jail, and for a while there it looked like his sentence was going to be quite lengthy, that they were going to make an example out of him for doing this. So that's the background in the story, and he does touch upon that right at the beginning, but then he goes right into the story of the escape, and what a harrowing story it is.
So this originated at this production of Riding the Midnight Express with Billy Hayes originated at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and then it's going to be here through March 23rd. And then it's actually going over to the Soho Theater and the West End. So there's a number of chances for folks who are listening to us to get a chance to see it if it's something that's up your alley. All right, so it kind of wraps it up for today. Anything else you guys want to throw in before we say goodbye?
Michael, didn't you have a few things that you mentioned? Oh, sure, the Back to the Future musical, right.
Yes, Back to the Future is becoming a musical in London first, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, we like to be positive, but the first red flag is that it's going to have a mixture, apparently, of pre-existing songs that I guess were heard in the movie. I mean, the movie's not a musical, but some new songs. So I always think that that can be kind of dicey.
God, I adore that movie.
Yes, you were saying. Yeah, I loved it too when it came. I haven't seen it since it came out. I would like to see it again.
And also in the news this week is that It's Gone But Not Forgotten. Spider-Man is back in the news with one of the actors who has been injured at Spider-Man has filed a lawsuit against the production. So
Daniel Curry.
Yeah, we'll see how this progresses, and we'll stay on top of it as well.
So as a result, Spider-Man may lose more than $65 million.
Yes. You know what I cannot understand, and maybe we could just very briefly discuss this. In the reports on it, it says they are still not detailing exactly the extent of his injuries. There was a report that it involved amputations, but there has been no more specific report since then, and I can't imagine why there wouldn't be, because at this point, I mean, some people had been suggesting something about a gag order against, you know, people. But in this case, now the lawsuit has been filed, and whatever his injuries are, I mean, obviously that there's a record of it, you know, from what happened at the hospital. So I can't figure out why they're not being more specific.
Well, it's all going to come out. You know, maybe they, for some strategic reason, they are holding
this
back.
They
want to wait on it. But, you know, things in courts don't happen like Perry Mason, where there's these big surprises. There's no surprises in a court. If you bring up something that's a surprise to the defense, or the defense brings up something that's a surprise to the other side, the court will actually take a break and give the other side opportunity to examine that evidence and come back and make a case for it. So I can't figure that either, but surely, you know, perhaps this is one of their cards. They haven't released all this information because they're still negotiating for a settlement. And if they negotiate for a settlement, part of the settlement will be none of this information will be disclosed.
Oh, and, okay. Yeah, well, that would explain it, wouldn't it? If they are still negotiating for a settlement.
Yeah, sure. A lawsuit is merely a tool for negotiation in many, many cases. And we'll see what's happened here. But whether or not they will lose more than $65 million, I think that they have insurance that will pay this out. So I don't think the production itself will lose anything, or else this gentleman who filed the lawsuit may end up getting nothing because the corporation's probably closed that employed him. So if a corporation's closed, you can't get blood from a stone. So
assuming that it does actually happen in Las Vegas as it's supposed to, that will have been restructured as a completely different corporation.
Absolutely. Every single national tour, every single production of every show is a separate corporation. And that's why you'll hear like Phantom had multiple corporations. There's the Broadway company, there's the Raoul company, there's the Music Box company. These are physically different corporate structures to separate monies.
But even though that's true, it's fair to ask, what will that do to the insurance premiums of that production?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, just like anything else, if you have if you're going out to get car insurance, they're going to check your driver's license to see how many accidents, tickets, things like that you have, and that'll affect your premiums. And so the history of the production will affect, you know, their future stuff as well. It's all a big corporate game.
Yes.
So we'll have to see what happens there, but we're very interested in the safety of everybody on Broadway. So that's about it for this week. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, you can listen to us in other ways. One of the ways is a Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and it'll stream This Week on Broadway automatically to you. We are played in other venues, such as Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Information for contacting Michael, Peter, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Since my puberty began, I crashed the junior prom and met the only married man. I'm always on tap for romance or chocolate that's bittersweet. You can always count on me. A matter of fact, if you want an ill-fated love affair, you can always count on me. A pact to carry out research before I care. Men don't give a warranty. One Joe who swore he's single got me sort of crotched the beast. I woke up only slightly shocked that I defrocked a priest. Or else I attract the guys who are longing to do my hair.